Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll discuss current housing concerns and what lessons can be learned by looking back to the 2008 housing crisis. Prisons were a prime spot for COVID outbreaks, and that prompted most prison education to come to a stop. Some instructors are still trying to stay in touch with those behind bars and keep them learning. And when it comes to John Dillinger, possibly his most legendary moment came when he broke out of an Indiana jail and stole a police car for his getaway.
The car was abandoned in the streets of Chicago. The Chicago Police Department confiscated the car, and then it was auctioned off.
Now that vehicle is back home. And we'll discuss the state's delays in renewing FOID cards in Illinois. Those stories and more ahead on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, what lessons learned from the 2008 housing crisis can be applied to today? We'll hear from some researchers. And in 1934, John Dillinger was brought to an Indiana jail. It was considered escape-proof. It didn't turn out that way. Now a key piece of that moment in history has made it back home. That story and more coming up on Statewide. Illinois is behind on processing renewals of firearm owner ID cards and concealed carry licenses, but the Illinois State Police says progress is being made, and this week another extension of 150 days was given to those waiting. Peter Hancock is with Capital News Illinois. He's reported on this issue, and he joins me now. Peter, just how long have some people been waiting?
I've heard anecdotally that some people have been waiting 9 months or even more in some cases. The problem seems to have been that the state police really didn't have the budget and didn't have the personnel to handle the large inflow of applications, especially renewal applications that they were receiving. And part of that has to do with the budget impasse from a few years ago. The fee fund that is used to pay for the personnel and the administrative cost was getting swept on a regular basis to pay for other government functions. And so they just really were not in a position when this large inflow of applications came in, really in 2019, 2020.
Why is this inflow so large at this particular time?
Well, FOID cards, the firearm owner identification cards, are issued for 10 years. And 2019-2020 marked 10 years after the last big wave that they had. So it kind of goes on a cycle. Also, I think you saw in 2020, a lot of people were very apprehensive about the pandemic. They were apprehensive about the civil unrest that was going on. And there was a lot of interest in self-protection, and gun sales increased.
So, Peter, what is the impact for people who haven't been able to get the renewals so far? Is there an impact on them?
Well, yeah, there is. I mean, the state has been going along, you know, just sort of it's called a conditional extension of your license, that if you've applied for a renewal, you've paid the fee, and you haven't done anything that would disqualify you from owning a gun, they say just go ahead and consider it valid. Problem is that from what I've heard anecdotally, there are a lot of gun shops whose insurance companies are saying, you know, we don't care. The law says you cannot sell guns or ammunition to somebody who doesn't have a valid FOID card. And I've heard that was a particular problem during deer and waterfowl hunting season in the fall and winter. Some, you know, avid hunters were not able to get their ammunition or to buy new guns or whatever to go hunting.
Well, a legislative panel heard about this issue this week. You covered that. State police, they testified there. What was said? Did they give kind of an update on where we stand at this point?
This is part of what's called the administrative rulemaking process. And so the state police proposed this rule that provides for the 150-day extension. These are called emergency rules, and if they're approved, they're only allowed to exist for 150 days at a time. And before it becomes finalized, it goes before what's called the Joint Committee on Administrative Rules, JCAR. And they had some questions this time around about the backlog. And the update that we got from them was that they have hired, just in the last year, a significant number of people to help clear up the backlog. They've improved some of their processes, whatever. So they said, we are making a dent in it. Interestingly, the next day, we're taping this on Wednesday today, legislation was introduced and there was a news conference supported by the Illinois State Police that would help them modernize the system. Part of it is, you know, the FOID cards go on 10-year cycles, concealed carry licenses go on 5-year cycles. What they would like to do is say, you know, since the background check process is the same for both, that when you renew your concealed carry license, it will automatically renew your FOID license. You don't have to do two applications. It would also allow for the issuance of digital cards instead of the little plastic cards that kind of look like driver's licenses that you could carry around on your phone. A lot of modernization, things like that, that they say would not only speed up the process, but help them be more accurate in identifying people who shouldn't have these cards.
Yeah, and the idea of licensing people who want to do conceal carry or requiring someone to have a FOID card, that is for public safety reasons. Is this delay causing some concern about compromising safety?
Well, I haven't heard that particular concern come up. The main concern has been that people who want to buy firearms have not been able to. And there is, in fact, a federal lawsuit going on in Chicago where the Illinois State Rifle Association and the organization called the Second Amendment Foundation are suing the state, saying this basically amounts to a denial of the right to bear arms.
Well, going back to what you mentioned earlier about state police trying to modernize, they're hiring more people. That takes training. It takes time. 150-day extension has been given now. Is, you know, I'm not a math major, but it does it seem as though that another extension may be coming down the road? Are they going to be able to catch up enough in that period of time?
It's unknown right now. They say they are making significant progress. They don't believe that they will have to repeal this emergency rule within that 150-day window. A lot of it also depends on what happens with the pandemic. That caused the Illinois State Police to have to shift a lot of resources to deal with other things. I mean, the pandemic has put stress on every state agency, just like it's stressed every person in Illinois.
Peter Hancock is a reporter for Capital News Illinois. You can find a link to his article about delays in renewal of FOID cards and concealed carry licenses in Illinois. That's at our program's website, statewideshow.com. And Peter, thanks once again.
Well, thank you, Sean.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the B117 or UK variant of COVID-19 is now the most common in the U.S., and Dr. Aaron Rossi with Pekin's Reditus Labs says that's likely true here in Illinois as well, based off recent tests conducted by his company. Of 323 positive tests recently pulled for sampling, 50% were the B117 variant, and research suggests the UK variant is considerably more contagious than the original strain of COVID, but it doesn't necessarily lead to more severe illness or death. Current vaccines on the market are considered effective against the UK variant. As Illinois prisons prepare to allow in-person visitation again, an Illinois Department of Corrections spokesperson says the system has done well managing COVID-19. Illinois Department of Corrections spokesperson Lindsay Hess says the department expects vaccinations to keep increasing in the coming weeks.
Overall, it's gone very well, especially considering that this is unprecedented, nothing that like we've ever seen before.
According to the Marshall Project, 88 prisoners in Illinois have died from COVID-19. Meanwhile, Illinois prisons will have a phased rollout of in-person visitation over the next few weeks, and Hess says facilities will reopen 3 weeks after inmates receive the second dose of the vaccine. And because Illinois prisons have been hotbeds for infection through the pandemic, most prison education programs have had to shut down. Peter Medlin has more on how those programs are trying to stay in contact with their students with no internet, and why prison education lowers reincarceration more than almost anything else.
Over 10,000 people incarcerated in Illinois prisons have tested positive for COVID-19. That's one out of every three people serving time. And with incarcerated students cycling into quarantine, it's made it impossible for education services to continue in person. Rebecca Ginsburg is director of the Education Justice Project, which provides on-site programming and resources at the Danville Correctional Center through the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She says it's been really difficult knowing these students are at risk and being unable to have any real contact with them.
People have died in prisons across Illinois. I have colleagues who have lost students to COVID. Thank goodness we haven't to date lost any BJP students to COVID, but you know, the pandemic isn't over yet.
Ginsburg says people might assume they could do online learning like other students, but there is none for prison education. Other programs have ceased completely, but the Education Justice Project was able to keep some courses going through paper correspondence. Danville Correctional Center allowed the EJP to drop off assignments along with blank paper to write on. So students would complete the work, and then 2 weeks later, project staff would pick them up, grade them, and drop them off 2 weeks after that. That means if students in prison have a question for their professor, it takes a month to hear back. They had to totally stop running correspondence courses in the fall due to case rates inside the prison, which Ginsburg says was the right call by the Department of Corrections.
We didn't want to do anything that jeopardized our students' well-being, whether that involved giving them additional contact with correctional officers, who were the main carriers of COVID, or requiring them to compromise their quarantine.
The project's been able to restart the correspondence courses this spring for their 75 students, and Ginsburg says there are more who hope to join post-pandemic, but there's already a wait list. There's also a lack of opportunity for incarcerated students outside of the Chicago area. Dr. Sharon Varallo is trying to address that opportunity gap. She's a professor at Augustana College and director of its new grant-funded prison education program, which she says will hopefully launch this summer depending on the pandemic. Along with a few colleagues, she's been helping teach at the East Moline Correctional Facility as part of the Graduated Release Initiative and as a volunteer. She first got involved with prison education work after a family member was charged with a violent crime they didn't commit, a charge that was later overturned. Through that arduous and expensive process, she learned how much education helps reduce reincarceration.
Criminal justice reform and higher ed in prison in particular are one of the very few areas in this country that have bipartisan support. I mean, every indicator is that it is worth it.
According to a study from the nonprofit research organization RAND, every $1 invested in prison education saves $5 in costs over the first 3 years after a person's release. Varallo taught a learning inquiry class at East Moline that she normally teaches first-year Augustana students. She says they were often surprised they could understand the same material as college students.
For the most part, they were not used to being treated as someone who was capable of learning.
Varallo and her colleagues are in the application process now and will select 10 students for the Augustana full credit degree program.
It will be hard, but those 10 people will set themselves up for a very hard experience. College is hard, but it's going to be one of the best things that they've ever done. It'll be winning the lottery.
Rebecca Ginsburg at the Education Justice Project says the pandemic also gave them the opportunity to innovate. The project used grant funds to create instructional videos available to anyone in the prison through institutional TV channels.
Many of the instructors are formerly incarcerated. They might have trouble getting clearance to teach within the prison itself, but now they can share their wisdom.
She says she hopes news attention of unsafe prison conditions during COVID, along with renewed conversations about racial justice, will push the expansion of prison education after the pandemic. I'm Peter Medlin.
It was 88 years ago that the outlaw John Dillinger broke out of an Indiana jail and stole a police car for his getaway. Now the vehicle is being returned to the small Indiana city forever linked to that moment. Adam Pinsker tells us more.
It may just be a car, but it received a police escort worthy of a hero or celebrity, a car almost as infamous as the man who stole it. Hundreds of people lined up recently along Main Street in downtown Crown Point, Indiana, a town of 30,000 people in the northwest corner of the state, to see what's basically an old car, a 1933 Ford V8 stolen by gangster John Dillinger. Steve Leontaris was eager to see it.
The Dillinger story is big for us here.
The car arrived in nearly the same condition it left town in, its shiny black paint job glistening in the cool spring sun. Local realtor Roger Pace helped organize the vehicle's return.
The lights, the siren, the light here is all original to the car.
In the early 1930s, Dillinger, a native Hoosier, was the FBI's public enemy number one. Dillinger and his gang were responsible for a dozen bank robberies in Indiana and throughout the Midwest. Jim Emerson is a board member of the old Lake County Jail and Sheriff's House and is well-versed in John Dillinger history. He says Dillinger's crime spree took place during the Great Depression and was often celebrated by many in the public.
They feel that the banks were in effect taking the homes from people, foreclosing on them, and they looked at Dillinger as a Robin Hood.
In January of 1934, while robbing a bank in nearby East Chicago, Indiana, Dillinger shot and killed police officer William Patrick O'Malley. Dillinger and his gang escaped to Arizona, where he was arrested and extradited to this county jail in Crown Point. It's a museum now, but these are the doors to Dillinger's cell block. The jail was touted as escape-proof, but Roger Pace says it wasn't secure enough to hold Dillinger.
An unscrupulous attorney out of Chicago had a Bible, and he hollowed out the form of a wooden gun and placed it in the Bible, knowing that they wouldn't look at a Bible.
Dillinger used that fake gun to escape. Dillinger's story ended months later when he was shot and killed by FBI agents in Chicago. But Pace says that was only the beginning of the story about Sheriff Lillian Holley's squad car.
The car was abandoned in the streets of Chicago. The Chicago Police Department confiscated the car, and then it was auctioned off.
The buyer moved it to Maine, and the car fell into disrepair. Pace and another Dillinger enthusiast were able to track it down and eventually restore it. Now this piece of history has been recovered and will soon be put on permanent display near the jail Dillinger broke out of in Crown Point. For NPR News, I'm Adam Pinsker.
And if you want to see the car, there is a link at statewideshow.com. You're listening to Statewide. There's more coming up. Stay with us. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Well, 6 years ago, the state of Illinois embarked on a plan to reduce fertilizer runoff into waterways. So far, those efforts haven't worked. With Harvest Public Media, Dana Cronin reports on how Illinois and other Mississippi River Basin states got off track.
A tile drainage pipe ushers runoff from a central Illinois farm into the East Branch Embra River. This water will flow through the Wabash, Ohio, and Mississippi rivers before ending up in the Gulf of Mexico. Nitrogen and phosphorus levels will build as the water passes through more and more fertilizer-laden farmland, which, after nourishing crops, results in a dead zone off the coast of Texas and Louisiana.
So this is cereal rye.
Joe Rothermel's farm partially drains into that East Branch Embra River. Of his 1,100-acre corn and soybean operation, he plants cover crops on 800 of those acres.
Very good for suppressing weeds, holding in moisture.
By preventing soil erosion, cover crops help reduce Rothermel's pollution into the river. But despite his and other farmers' efforts, agriculture is still the largest contributor to nutrient runoff, which is why many Mississippi River Basin states have adopted plans to reduce their impact on the Gulf's dead zone, including Illinois. The basic goal of Illinois' nutrient loss reduction strategy is to cut nitrogen and phosphorus loads almost in half. More immediately, the aim is to reduce nitrogen by 15% and phosphorus by 25% in the next 4 years. But so far, it's not working. In fact, the situation is getting worse.
Unfortunately, right now, no. We're actually going the other way.
Trevor Sample is with Illinois' Environmental Protection Agency and coordinates the nutrient loss reduction strategy. He says between 2015 and 2019, nitrogen and phosphorus loads have increased by 13 and 37% respectively compared to the baseline numbers.
And a lot of that is because we're seeing increases in flows.
The massive amount of rain in 2019 meant that more water flowed into rivers, 25% more to be exact. And with that increased flow comes increased nutrients. But there are other reasons Illinois hasn't yet improved its water quality, including a lack of money. By comparison, Iowa has dedicated $270 million to improving water quality. Jennifer Jones does watershed outreach with University of Illinois Extension. She says that money makes a big difference.
Whenever you look at Iowa, for example, it's just incredible to see the work that we've been able to do in Illinois without assistance from, you know, maybe the state level as much.
While Illinois does fund some conservation programs, there's currently no state money going directly to reducing nutrient runoff. Right now, the state is mostly relying on education. And that's what makes Jones's job so important. She helps make a podcast dedicated to the issue.
This is the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast, Episode 25, Uncovering the Benefits of Cover Crops.
The podcast covers everything from the benefits of constructed wetlands to which cover crops to plant. More resources like this are needed, says Michael Woods, who manages the Illinois Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Division. A recent Illinois State University survey found that fewer than half of Illinois farmers had even heard of the strategy.
The success of this initiative and the success of protecting our environment while sustaining our agricultural operations really comes down to education.
Joe Rothermel, the Central Illinois farmer, thinks it will also take financial incentives and technological advances. And he says we can't leave all of that up to farmers.
Conservation is not free. And farmers, you know, are going to have to pay for this themselves, or somebody else is going to have to pay or help pay. And I'm not sure it should be totally on the farmer.
Rothermel says he's hopeful the new Biden administration will contribute federal dollars to conservation programs, including programs aimed at cutting down on farm runoff. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Farmers along the Missouri River are suing the Army Corps of Engineers for property damages due to flooding. Farmers and environmentalists have fought for years over whether the government should prioritize the river's endangered animals or human interests. But as Christina Stella reports, some say it's not clear who's winning that battle.
After the catastrophic floods of 2019, Mike Bean's 680 acres of Missouri River farmland became a kind of museum. Refrigerators, buoys, and an aquarium's worth of fish washed up with 9 feet of flood water.
You know, and there was carp, but there was catfish, there was all sorts of stuff. But it's sad seeing them. They got trapped in here, and then they couldn't get out.
What also got trapped are many tons of dirt that settled on his land. Bean has been shelling out big money to relevel his fields.
So right here, you're talking $800,000. To me, 25% is out of my pocket, so that's 200. So I am not gaining. I mean, they're seriously whacking me.
Costly damages like these are why Bean is one of many landowners suing the Army Corps of Engineers for their management of the Missouri River. Farmers say changes the agency made in the early 2000s caused years of floods. Those policies came after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service told the Corps that under the Endangered Species Act, they needed to better protect two birds and one fish. Enter the pallid sturgeon, long and lean, like a dinosaur met a swordfish.
It's a very rare fish, and it lives at the bottom of a deep and very muddy river. It's very hard for us to actually just observe what this fish does.
That's Dr. Robert Jacobson, chief of the U.S. Geological Survey's River Studies branch. He says previous changes to the river made it easier for barges to travel, but experts suspect they also made life harder for baby pallid sturgeon.
The dominant hypothesis is they're getting stuck in the main channel and being transported way downstream. They can't get off to the side of the channel when they need to start feeding. So they're starving instead of surviving.
Over the last 20 years, the Corps has tried out several ideas to help pallid sturgeon, like building more shallow water habitats. Dan Bulware, a lawyer in Kansas City, argues that's just one policy that created flood risk for farmers. He sued the Corps for hundreds of growers, including Michael Bean.
Well, the two birds are now off the endangered species list, but when you compare the losses that have happened with the citizenry, it's a real disaster. That's why you have the Fifth Amendment that you can't take private property without compensation.
A court of federal claims judge agreed with that take last December. She gave Boulware 2 weeks to find more farmers who wanted payments for another lawsuit before the statute of limitations ran out.
Now, many people never thought we would win this case, so they didn't join. Well, once that decision came out, people were coming out of the woodwork calling us.
This second suit opens a new chapter in the showdown between business and environmental interests on the river. If it's successful, farmers from northern Nebraska down to Kansas City could pocket hundreds of millions in damages from the Corps. But would it actually change any policies? Boulware thinks the money doesn't matter.
They have already tried to change the management of the river in some respects, but they can't with what they did because it's going to take years to take the river back to where it was.
Plus, more research is needed to know if the Corps' first attempts at helping pallid sturgeon worked. Jacobson adds this fish is famously elusive and doesn't even reproduce for 12 to 18 years.
It's a legitimate question. If you've done these changes to the channel, how do you know it's working? It's really hard to know how it's working.
But there's been momentum in recent years to test theories more aggressively. Still, answers won't come as soon as farmers like Michael Bean want them.
I think they ought to get back to the basics and do what their job is. And I think they ought to be held accountable to people. And after 2011, we've heard all the excuses, and this is the once-in-500-year flood. Really, 8 years later, it happens again. That's not 500 years. That's eight.
Bean says the settlement won't make up for all of his losses. But for many farmers, it's better than nothing. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
Working from home has become a thing during the pandemic, so too has working out from home. Jen Blair does personal training at a fitness studio she owns in Bloomington, and she talked with Eric Stock, telling him business is up 20% over pre-pandemic levels as more people learn to work out at home or in small studios. But she says it was scary when the pandemic hit, and she didn't know when clients would return.
You know, if I don't work, I don't get paid, but at the same time, I still have gym bills that are due and I'm bringing in no income. So that was very scary, and having that happen for 10 weeks was pretty scary. But I have amazing, awesome, like faithful clients that are all like my family. So I had a good handful that wanted to do Zoom sessions. So that worked out great. We, you know, set it up and did our regular times that we would work out. So 2 to 3 times a week. And I would do it in my basement. They would do it at home. So that was great because I was working out every day with my clients and getting to see some of those faces. Not everyone, you know, did that, but I had a handful that did. So that was still awesome.
How did your clients' habits change for working out?
So I would say, you know, it's kind of a mix. I have a client page and I would post workouts on there for them 3 times a week. So I liked to still kind of check in with them and make sure that they were doing their own workouts at home on their own. I know some were, and some came back to me that first I was opened and were so honest. And they were like, hey, I didn't do a thing while we were off. you know, and I understand it's a scary time for everyone. It's different for everybody. So that was okay too. And we just picked right back up where we left off. I know some people, you know, felt great and they had more time at home with their kids. So they were getting the whole family involved and they were all working out as a family, which was great. And some of them told me they were working out, you know, 5-6 days a week, going on runs with their family. And that was great. So I loved kind of getting texts each day from everybody. But I know when the gym opened back up and we could get back to doing things like rope slams and punching bag and sled pushes, that everybody was super excited to, you know, kind of get some of that bigger stuff that they don't get to do at home.
So what are the common questions you get from people who have worked out at a gym up until now and they couldn't get there anymore, but they want to stay active?
Well, a lot of people are wanting to know what they could do with their own body weight if they didn't have weights. And, you know, during the pandemic, weights were really hard to come by. I mean, I had some people that couldn't get any weights for, you know, 4 to 6 weeks. So we had to get really creative with what we could do, even getting outside and getting some fresh air in their backyard. I would try to post for my clients different meals that I was making at home, healthy things that they could kind of duplicate at home with their family since restaurants were closed. And so even though it was a really tough time, I think for some people, it was great to kind of cook more often where maybe on a regular basis, they weren't cooking as much, weren't using as much fresh ingredients and that type of thing.
What are the common mistakes that people make trying to work out from home if they don't have the structure that they are used to in a gym?
Well, I would say one of the biggest things is form. That's why I really like in-person, you know, sessions so I can watch everybody's form really, really closely. If they get some kettlebells and that type of thing and they're trying to do things at home, oftentimes their form can be off and they can hurt their back or hurt their knees.
Now, a gym can be intimidating for some, but for others, they sort of look for that separation from home to focus on it. Has the work from home model changed that for people since we're doing everything else from home now?
Well, I would say for some of my clients, they're still working from home and they haven't gone back to their office yet. So for some of them, they really like that flexibility to where they can come into the gym, maybe over their lunch hour where they normally wouldn't have time to get to my gym over their lunch hour and work out. That type of thing has been nice for some people and they've really liked that part of it. I know that a lot of people working at home, they're loving to come back to the gym to kind of get that social hour as well because they're not getting that at home sitting in front of the computer all day long.
Personal trainer Jen Blair. She says she plans to offer a mix of virtual and in-person classes in the future. The scarcity of COVID vaccine appointments in parts of Illinois is prompting some residents to travel up to several hours to get vaccinated. Mary Hansen spoke with a few Illinoisans about why they made recent trips to Springfield's mass vaccination site and what so-called vaccine tourism reveals about distribution of the life-saving shots.
In a large building at the corner of the Illinois State Fairgrounds, rows of folding chairs sit 6 feet apart. Here, Lisa Scocco, sporting an I Got My COVID-19 vaccine sticker, spends the observation period after her first dose of the Pfizer vaccine.
I feel great. Yeah. I'm happy. I'm excited.
Scocco is from Arlington Heights in Chicago's northwest suburbs. She made the more than 3-hour drive to Springfield on a recent Sunday morning with a couple friends. She says she tried unsuccessfully for days to book an appointment closer to home when she became eligible for the shot.
A lot of refreshing, a lot of, it looks like it's going to give you an appointment, but it's not the most searching of anyone that I know, but enough.
A friend who qualified for a vaccine in an earlier phase received his first dose in Springfield and told Scocco how easy it was, so she signed up. The site is open to any Illinois resident 16 and older. Scocco and her friends are among around 2,500 Cook County residents who have booked appointments at the state fairgrounds so far, about a tenth of the more than 27,000 slots between mid-February and the end of this month.
We were surprised and pleased that people are coming from other areas because they've heard that we are operating a very good and efficient site.
That's Gail O'Neill, director of the Sangamon County Health Department, which runs the site with support from the Illinois National Guard. An easy process is part of the appeal. The site also has many available slots. O'Neill says it provides around 1,200 shots a day, but hundreds of appointments go unfilled.
And that's still a lot of people, and we're happy about it. But we wanted to get it up to full gear and see the 2,000 people come through.
Because of the availability, Sangamon County's health department expanded eligibility to the general public 2 weeks earlier than the rest of Illinois. And O'Neill says she also turned down a couple of shipments of vaccine doses from the state.
So for the last couple weeks, we have declined so that it could go to some of those other sites.
People traveling hours for an appointment shows flaws in vaccine distribution, says Dr. William Parker. He's the assistant director of the McLean Center for Clinical Medical Ethics at the University of Chicago.
I don't think there's anything wrong with that on a personal level, but it does reflect a larger failure at the state and federal government level.
That larger failure, Parker says, is not distributing the vaccine in the most efficient way.
Efficiency doesn't necessarily mean speed. Efficiency means the vaccine distribution plan that optimizes the number of lives saved.
An efficient and equitable approach would be allocating doses to the areas hardest hit by the pandemic and places with rising case counts, so more would go to Chicago and its suburbs. A spokesperson for the Illinois Department of Public Health says some counties have skipped or pared down their requests for vaccine doses, and the department has reallocated them, prioritizing them for mass vaccination sites. And with a temporary pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, IDPH is sending its first shipment of doses to the city of Chicago, 50,000 of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. At the Illinois State Fairgrounds, locals from Sangamon County have booked the majority of appointments, followed by those from Cook County, and then residents from McLean. That includes Darla Carmona and her 16-year-old son, who are from Bloomington.
When it opened up that 16-year-olds could come, I got one immediately before we opened in Bloomington.
Carmona says she feels the urgency as COVID case counts rise.
The numbers are going up so quick with the kids back at school, back in sports. So I really think the only way we're going to stop this is if we get vaccinated.
Carmona's son, Alex, is back in school 4 days a week and playing soccer.
I just want the shot done so I can, like, have it. I'm not going to do anything different. I'm just going to wear my mask.
Alex and Lisa Scocco from Cook County are scheduled to travel back to Springfield in a few weeks for their second shots. I'm Mary Hansen.
There is more of Statewide ahead. Stay with us. Welcome back to Statewide. A new report is calling for potentially higher energy bills to keep two of Illinois' nuclear power plants in operation. This fall, Exelon Generation wants to mothball money-losing power plants Dresden and Byron. Those supply power to 4 million residents in northern Illinois. To keep the plants going, a new study commissioned by the Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker's administration justifies roughly $350 million in ratepayer help during the next 5 years. Christian Mitchell is Pritzker's deputy governor and point person on utility issues.
The governor's deeply committed to keeping these plants open. They're 54% of our power in the state of Illinois. They are a massive percentage, like the lion's share of our clean power.
Lawmakers were briefed on the report this week, and it's still unclear if Exelon will want more. Ideas to deal with current COVID-19-related housing problems can be found by looking to what worked and what didn't in the 2008 housing crisis. University of Illinois professors Michelle Laser and Andrew Greenlee are the lead authors of a recent report, one of a series the Institute of Government and Public Affairs has produced on coping with the pandemic, and they spoke with our Maureen McKinney.
What are the ways you found that we could ease the housing problem now by looking at the 2008 crisis?
In 2008, there was a real emphasis on alleviating stress on individuals by implementing policies that encourage banks and private institutions to grant relief to individuals. Policies were certainly helpful, but they weren't as helpful as policymakers had hoped. And part of this was just a reluctance among private actors to actually participate in these programs. In the current crisis, we point to that as a really strong reason to think hard about providing assistance directly to individuals. So whether we're talking about tenants or homeowners, we can't rely entirely on their mortgage lenders or their landlords to grant relief through incentive programs. Now, the policy response in this crisis has been very different. We've seen actual mandated freezes on evictions, moratoriums on mortgage foreclosures. To the extent that those freezes have been enforced, they've been rather successful at staving off a brewing crisis. The problem is these foreclosure and eviction freezes are not going to last forever. They've been extended many times, but eventually they're going to have to be lifted. And at that point, we're going to see a lot of people who are at risk of eviction or foreclosure on their homes unless they have been provided direct monetary support.
What are some of the different tacks that can be applied to help?
A more expansive set of programs, an expansion of the Housing Choice Voucher program, expansion of homeowner assistance, also housing counseling and fair housing, utility assistance. And so that these types of things are designed to help to create a much broader basis for stable housing for a wide swath of owners and renters throughout the country. And so the expansion of those things is really important in this moment when we're seeing what's likely to be a long-tailed recovery.
How does Illinois compare to other states in terms of offering aid?
States have been implementing assistance programs for their residents. But there's been a lot of variation across jurisdictions. Illinois has state-level assistance programs, as well as some city and county rent assistance programs, but they've been oversubscribed. The effort has been there, the funding has been implemented, but the number of people who need support and are applying for this support has been greatly outpaced the amount of funding and assistance that's actually available.
You talked about ways that COVID exacerbated housing woes for low-income people in particular. Can you explain that?
In the time period leading up to COVID,
Right. It's important to note that we were facing a national housing crisis, especially for low-income households. Affordability remains a challenge throughout the country, and in almost everywhere in the U.S. on minimum wages, a low-income worker cannot afford a average-priced rental housing unit. And so what we've seen is that the additional instability caused by the coronavirus pandemic has only exacerbated an existing crisis and an existing set of challenges which many households were facing. And so what we're seeing really is a result not just of the instability associated with the pandemic, but of broader instability within our housing system. Out of the crisis that we're experiencing in this moment, there really is an opportunity for us to fundamentally rethink some of the nature of how we support low-income homeowners and low-income renters. And so one of the reasons that we really wanted to write this policy brief was to highlight the need for some of that structural change, and also to highlight some of the potential for us to come out of this moment with a more robust and more supportive housing system for all Americans.
And what would do that?
One of the things that we highlight is the importance of providing stable funding for existing housing programs, like the Housing Choice Voucher Program. Talk some about ways to further refine and enhance existing place-based investment policies like Opportunity Zone. This is a newer policy strategy designed to spur investment in low-income communities. It's designed to spur private investment in those communities. And we see opportunities to refine the existing policy to enhance the capacity of that program to deliver those benefits specifically to low-income renters and owners. We note that within eviction proceedings, that most landlords come with representation and most renters don't. We also note that when renters do have representation, the outcomes tend to be more favorable to them.
Is this a statewide issue, or is it mainly urban?
Oh, I think this is statewide. I think that there have been probably more programs implemented for some of the more urban areas specifically, but we know that people throughout the country are struggling to keep up with their rental payment. COVID has been a major economic disruption whereby people have had seen reduced work hours, or women in particular have left the workplace. You know, even before COVID, most people couldn't endure, you know, major disruptions to their payment while also keeping up with their housing costs. So whether we're talking about urban areas or more rural, you know, this has affected everybody in this country. And so, you know, I think that that's particularly to the extent that we're seeing some of the more urban areas more effectively and efficiently put together rent assistance programs, while rural areas may be more dependent on state level programs. It's just all the more reason to keep an eye on how well our policies are reaching people in different geographies.
And you wrote that there are disparate impacts for people of color. Can you talk about that?
For people of color, we note severe impacts with regards to housing instability. And again, some of this echoes broader social and economic challenges faced by many minority groups. Again, pre-existing issues to the pandemic. These are issues that are not just about minority individuals within urban areas, but also within rural communities as well, throughout the state of Illinois and throughout the country.
Do either of you have a sense of how long it will take the nation and the state to recover from the effects of the pandemic?
We have an immediate crisis to be dealt with to prevent a wave of evictions, but we expect that this will be a continued issue, and the housing need is going to be increased for some time following the pandemic, which is, You know, one of the things that we try to highlight, because I have a concern that we're going to focus on the immediate crisis right now, and then once the crisis passes, this may fall off of people's radars, but that doesn't mean that the housing markets in the will have recovered. We are suggesting that attention be placed on affordable housing supply more generally, particularly to address that long-term need. So whether that is providing a larger housing voucher program that will provide for those long-term rental assistance needs, or whether it is providing rent-subsidized units through new affordable housing development. We need to see some sort of long-term policies in place to address the continued fallout of the pandemic, because it's not going to end when this virus is over.
What might some of those actions be?
So there's two main ways to address housing affordability needs. The largest programs that we see at the federal level, in particular, are the Housing Choice Voucher Program that Andy has mentioned. The way that that program works is it provides housing vouchers to renters that allows them to present that voucher to their landlord as a rent subsidy. The tenants themselves are responsible for a portion of the rent, but the remainder of the rent due is subsidized by the government. That program is really great at reaching very low-income tenants. It's unfortunately much too small to really put a meaningful dent in the affordability problem, right? There are far, far, far more people who need to be subsidized in their housing than the voucher program is able to cover. The second approach is to provide new affordable housing and subsidized units. This is, you might think of this as public housing, but a lot of it is actually developed by private developers at this point, subsidized through the federal low-income housing tax credit and state-level tax credit programs and subsidies. Those projects end up producing actual buildings with rental units that are capped in their rent, and they are earmarked for low-income tenants. They tend not to provide as big of a subsidy as the vouchers, but they play a really important role in providing those affordable housing opportunities because voucher-holding tenants have access to those units. Together, these voucher-based programs and actual place-based construction-based programs work together to meet a housing that is intended specifically to provide for long-term support. And so, you know, those are existing programs. I don't think we in our research have found that the most efficient way to address these problems is not going to be to come up with something new and exciting. It's to be to build onto and expand the programs that are working, because we already have an administrative system in place. We already have mechanisms for administering those programs. Nothing new needs to be done. It's just about funding, getting as much funding into these programs as we can so that we can expand them and make them more effective at addressing the need that exists.
Do you have a sense of how great the impact has been on homelessness, especially in Illinois?
The most recent American Rescue Plan Act devotes $5 billion throughout the country to addressing the needs of homeless individuals. But part of the challenge here, actually reflected within the broader eviction crisis. Homelessness takes many forms in the U.S. The most visible one might be street homeless, where we see people literally on the street. But one of the things that we're really paying attention to in this current moment are the nature of people being forced to double up and combine households as a result of being evicted. This, of course, represents a material hardship in terms of those households being doubled up and being homeless. But it also represents a significant risk with regards to the spread of coronavirus itself by creating larger households with more people and more contact with the outside world. And part of the challenge is thinking about how to understand the effects of that as COVID and variants continue to be an issue. So when we talk about the question of homeless assistance in this moment, we're
we're talking not just about addressing those needs, but we're also talking about addressing a major public health concern for individuals who may otherwise enter into the shelter system or who may double up and end up increasing the overall likelihood of the spread of COVID.
University of Illinois professors Michelle Laser and Andrew Greenlee, the lead authors of a recent report on housing for the U of I's Institute of Government and Public Affairs. That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. Join us next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. You can always find our episodes with links to stories you hear at our website, statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.